the third part, one of the verses in the third chapter, that if we just rely upon sentiment, then we may become fanatic. If we just rely upon philosophy, we may become speculators. So both things are necessary. And we saw Prabhupada sometimes experience what we would call ecstasy. And it was not superficial, when sometimes he would manifest tears in the eyes or become stunned and unable to talk. Sometimes people imitate these symptoms. And it takes a very discerning mind to distinguish between real symptoms and false symptoms. A group of Vals is one of the 13 Siddha Vaishnava sects, Prabhupada writes about it. A group of Vals from Bengal once came to San Francisco. The temple was beginning. And I noticed that one of them had a little poodle under his arm. He was already in the temple when I first met him. I thought he really wanted to welcome him because he was a Bengali and he was, you know, a Vaishnava of some description. But he had this dog, a little poodle, manicured little lap dog. And I wanted to welcome him, but I kept looking at the dog. And he finally realized that I was looking at the dog. And he said, "Should I take her out?" And I didn't want to say take her out because he didn't have a leash, and the dog didn't have a bone, and he'd probably run away or something like that. But anyway, to make a long story short, this man came to Kirtan a week later. And when we said the Prema Dwani prayers at the end, and it was a very ecstatic Kirtan, a lot of people were chanting, there was maybe 100 people there, chanting, dancing. He began to twirl around with his arms spread out. And he was wearing an orange, kind of a robe, I don't know what you call it, wasn't a dhoti, but it was very bright orange. And he was spinning and twirling, and at the end of the Kirtan, he just fell down flat like a dandelion and stretched out his arms and legs. And he wouldn't get up afterwards, after everyone got up, and many people, including a few devotees, were kind of trying to arouse him. He was just as if passed out completely. And I thought, this guy's faking. He's just doing this because so many people are gathering around him and think he's real. So the next day, Prabhupada asked the devotees what happened, what was their kirtan like, and they were telling him many things about how ecstatic it was. And then someone started telling about this man. His name was, well, I should say his name. I don't want to indulge in ad hominem attacks. But anyway, it was brought to Prabhupada's attention. And at this point, I couldn't resist saying that he wouldn't get up, and that I thought that he was kind of imitating Lord Chaitanya. And Prabhupada didn't say anything. He just looked very matter-of-fact. He said, "You should have said to him, like, Lord Chaitanya." And then kicked him in boots in the face. Everyone was kind of, whoa. Because a few devotees had kind of attended to him and tried to arouse him. Okay, maybe it was a manifestation of devices. But it's an indication that Prabhupada accepted individuality and kind of had this really discerning ability to see through imitations. And it's not an easy thing to do. We were talking yesterday about maturity, about preaching, and how we have to learn. And, you know, maybe some people had to learn by being in Prabhupada's room, by attending to this man, trying to arouse him, and then hearing what Prabhupada had to say. So maybe it wasn't really wrong to think that. And maybe it's part of the process of maturing and preaching that we have to, as the Bhagavad Gita said, to be nice. And we have to see that there's a super soul in everyone, whether it be a fallen person or an animal. Krishna is in there, or an insect. So we want to give lots of that. We want to see the devotional aspect of everyone. Prabhupada talked about this, it's one of the qualities of Krishna. It doesn't see the bad thing. But at the same time, and Prabhupada said this, we can't be foolish, because sometimes we may be deceived. And sometimes we may try to deceive the name of spirituality, thinking that everything is mundane morality, and that Krishna is above it all, and we can do anything, we can break any law, because Krishna's laws are higher. This is a common pitfall. We can remember that the Prabhupada honored people, like there was the governor of UP and others, and he would go way out of his way to give them a seat, to give them accommodation, speak sweet words to them, to give them food. These people were meat eaters. They were politicians. They weren't following and regulating the principles. But in one of his lectures, Prabhupada said, and said the Bhagavad Srimad Gurjitam Deva, that all wonderful, great, mighty, powerful things, they're manifestations of Krishna. And when Sanatana Goswami was in the service of the Nawab, they were the Pathans, the Islamic peoples that were ruling India at the time. Lord Chaitanya was carrying on his mission. And sometimes thousands of people would follow him around. Literally, follow him around. Thousands of people. He'd be moving across Bengal, and this whole train of people would be following his footsteps. So the Nawab became a little bit perturbed. Who is this man? This huge Baba. He became a little frightened that maybe he's going to usurp my power. Because after all, he's a politician. Politicians thrive on these things. So he asked Sanatana, he was his minister. So your mom was the baby. And he asked him, who is this Chaitanya Mahaprabhu? He's some kind of a Hindu saint or something. What is he? And so your mom said, you should not fear him. He's actually a great Muslim saint. Like a mullah or a whatever they're called, peer. And the Nawab accepted him as a great saint. He was hailed with piety. So even though he was a meteor, even though his religion was not up to the standard of Vaishnavism and so on, he was revered by even Sanatana Goswami who worked for him. And Prabhupada himself would revere such people, seeing that they were somehow manifestations of Krishna, because they had that power that was given to them. He said that in lectures too. So it's a mark of maturity, because on the one hand, we have to see that such people are attracted by Maya. Nowadays, everyone is looking to celebrities to be the answer to everything. The heroes of the age, even though they're violating every principle, even though some of them are so gross, it's just unspeakable. But people are attracted to them. Movie stars, rock stars, models, whatever they are. Every day they're paraded in front of us. They're on the front page of the Sun. They see them every day. The girly magazines. That's what they're like. These tabloids. So Maya is alluring us every moment. But if our attitude is one that we want to surrender to Krishna, if our attitude is one that we want to be devotees, that we want to read Prabhupada's books, that we are souls, and the soul is going to live on after the death experience, then we're not going to be victims of Maya. So this verse meant a lot to me when I first learned it about today on Jatanasana, because it established that we don't die, that we'll go through again. And Prabhupada said this time and time again, that we just have to realize this. He was astonished that many learned. As learned as they were accepting this very simple fact that we're not the body, that we lived before and that we'll live again, and that death is the end. There's a very wonderful picture that somebody painted in the Srimad Bhagavatam of a dying person. I think you can see him. The Yamadutas are just on the other side of the bedstead about to grab him and take him away to hellish existence, and all the family members are lamenting and crying and so on. But it's actually a very joyful experience for a devotee. He doesn't, at least we can see that Prabhupada didn't see it as an end, but as another great beginning. And there were great saints like Jayananda, for example, who at one time said, what is the use of this diseased body? Let me get another body, and I hope I can leave it before Srila Prabhupada leaves his. So these are some of the ways that devotees look at life and initiation and death. But these things aren't endings, they're beginnings. And when we see things that way, we're far, far less susceptible to Maya, who is trying at every turn to allure us into her pleasure. So I'm going to stop there and probably have a little bit of a preparation for this initiation, but I want to leave a little time for any comments or that you might have. Any enlargements on some things I've said or questions? I'm sure that I said some things that are wrong. And say something. Yes?
You said the stuff of the class, individuality is centralized within an organization. Could you comment on how someone can protect themselves from the compromised?
Well, the saying is that what is it, power corrupts? Absolutely, or something like that. Anyways, institutions have their value as individuality has its value. Even other faiths, Christians value the community that their churches have. So the Prabhupada thought it was very important for devotees to have community. Therefore, he established this in the seven principles, the initial principles of ISKCON. He said that it was very important to establish a community of devotees where people could associate with like-minded people. And the association is critical because if one gets into the association constantly of very materialistic people, the tendency is to become like them. The tendency is like that. Prabhupada used the example of the stock market. Everyone wants to know how much profit did you make, or what's happening with this stock? Is it going up or going down? Whereas with the society of devotees, people want to know, what is Krishna doing? What is Krishna doing? Or how can I become a better devotee? So Prabhupada talked about unity within diversity within unity. He talked about these very words, diversity and unity. So this is a very lofty thing. But it really is only achieved in spiritual life. Of course, people are trying to do it. Corporate world, they're trying to establish that everyone is an individual and we have to care for individuals' needs. And these are more caring companies. But the ultimate care really only comes when we are Bhavagrahi Janardana, when we're looking at the devotional characteristics of a person, when we see the super soul inside someone. That's how our real individuality is protected. And therefore, the institution of ISKCON is not an ordinary institution. It's an institution of true unity within diversity within unity. The Prabhupada wanted and established it. Okay, they may seem to be complicated, but that's our objective. That's our goal. That's our order from people that we respect, that we have to maintain individuality within the institution. Not easy. It has to be done. We have to figure out how to do it, and maybe we haven't figured out how to do it completely, but we have to do it somehow. Keep it trying. And when Jayapataka Maharaj mentioned the United Nations of the spiritual world, it's a very good example, because the United Nations isn't really united. They try to be united, but the Prabhupada said, you know, they're creating more and more divide. So they're not really united. They're just talking about it. And years, it's been over 50 years since the United Nations was formed. And after Harry Truman was the president of the United States, he said, this means that there's going to be an end to all war. He said that after World War II. But there's just fighting everywhere. Because there is no real unity in the world. Which is what one of Prabhupada's objectives was in the seven principles of this time. Establish real unity in the world. With Krishna as the prime entity. So if we remember Krishna, then our individuality is protected. And if we remember what Prabhupada wanted, then the institution is protected. Does that help? So I think we're going to prepare. We'll take a little break now. And
Should we? I think it's only you have 2 minutes, so I think 5 minutes.
Okay, so we can continue with discussion while he's setting up. Yes.
Maharaj, you're talking about this guy who fell down in the temple, you know.
About?
The guy who fell down in the temple when we all were chanting.
Yeah.
Well, it brought to mind Bush made a comment that he said that this God told him to go to war.
It's what?
God spoke to him. Yeah, he said God spoke to him and told him that to go to war against Saddam.
To what?
To war.
To war against Saddam.
Yeah.
God told him.
Yeah. So, how should we take this?
How should we take this?
Yeah,
Well, George Bush may be a great person and been given some power by Krishna.
Yes.
Not all wars, but many wars like the Crusades, are supposedly on the side of God. God told me to do this, so it's okay. The Muslims said that they told they should fight the Christians, and the Christians said that God told them to fight the Muslims. So who's right? Who did God really talk to? But one of the things Prabhupada said is that we can't really trust politicians. So they may be able to help us, and they certainly helped us by allowing for public worship of the conservative government as well. So we have to kind of think very carefully, what does it mean? And is it posturing? Is it true that God really spoke to him, or is it just political posturing? As if it's a political way to gain votes. Yeah, I believe you really said that. What I mean to say, what do we think that really means? Did God really talk to him? So we have to be very careful in discerning things. And we're getting this from a newspaper. The newspaper is saying that a politician said it. And we can't trust what the newspaper is saying. We can't trust the politicians either. So that's a double reason why the whole thing casts doubt upon such things. Anyway, it's as Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati said, we shouldn't be caught up in what he called the current of the world, meaning what newspapers say, what politicians say, and a lot of other things. We should think, what does Krishna want? And if Don Major's government gave us the permission to have public worship here, that's a good thing, undoubtedly. When George Bush says that God spoke to him, we don't know. We don't know that he spoke to him. Any others?
Ladies? Questions?
Yes. Anybody? Or comments? I mean, yes?
I was wondering about going back to individual within the whole society again. And, you know, for an individual to come to a movement and to really express themselves to the fullness, I was wondering how much we have to suppress our individuality to go up against Vaishnava Kala and how important that is. Do you understand my point?
Yeah. Individual power corrupts and what is it? How's that called?
Power corrupts.
Power corrupts and natural power corrupts absolutely. So that's a very popular saying. And what it means basically is that all institutions are irretrievably corrupt. What it means. If you're going to be an institution, you just have to sacrifice your individuality. It's a corrupt thing. But sometimes we have to surrender to the institution, even though we might not like it. Sometimes people have to work in the kitchen, but they don't know anything about the kitchen, or they don't like to work in the kitchen, but they have to do it because it needs to be done. So that's a case of putting a round peg in a square hole, you might say. Avoiding apparat or having to say, I'm not going to go in the kitchen. Who are you to tell me what to do? It's against my nature. That's not apparat. Because it has to be done. Sometimes we just have to surrender. So part of the act of surrender is sometimes surrendering our individuality. It doesn't mean that it goes away. Nothing, it's never going to be eradicated. It's always going to be there. that sometimes we have to give it up. Sometimes. Yes.
Is there any instance where you can say, well, this is just me, and there's absolutely no way I could avoid it. I could have avoided
it. It may happen.
You know, like, I'm aware of the severity of creating or causing Vaishnava Parada, but, like, far be it for me to say, I might find myself in a situation where I think I'm very neophyte, so say for example I was in a situation where I thought, this devotee is really getting on my nerves, do you know what I mean? But, you know, how should one deal with a situation like that?
Well, yes, there's one case where Prabhupada...
Well, I really go to the hedge panics if I do think yeah. such a
that somebody was trying to wake a devotee up to go to Mount Bharati, and he wouldn't move. and Prabhupada said that when someone is asleep, he can be awakened, but he's pretending to be asleep, then he cannot be awakened. sometimes, I mean, we have to be very mature and very discerning. We might have to say, I absolutely can't do that, or you absolutely fucking don't do this. Don't act that way. Sometimes it may be necessary. And it won't be an upper because it just gets to the point where it has to be said. So, I don't think there's a hard and fast rule that I could say to answer a question like that, because it so much depends on circumstances and the individual's concern and the development of your maturity and so on. But sometimes it happens. But I don't think you'll go to hell and have to rot in the hell's planets every time, you know, you kind of raise your voice against them. Yes?
Srila Prabhupada is here. Would you say that Islam was ruled by fear or by love?
I think it was a combination. I think that the fifth canto has mentioned that planets go around the pole star because it's fear. And so it's one of the ways that we learn to obey and be faithful to Krishna. But we're doing it because we love Krishna, not because it's because we want to do it. So I think both things are active. I don't think you can. I mean, if it's just fear and no love, that's like the regime that existed in Russia for 7 years. It was just fear, but ultimately love kind of won out. Of course, it's all mundane anyway. But it just, because it was based on fear, dictatorialness, it only lasted for about 70 years, Marxism and all that. Yes?
Maharaj, we seem to control our behavior externally by the vows that we take and by the ethos that we accept from the organization like ISKCON. What is the karmic reaction for the faults that we think is not in line with our vows?
Well, fortunately, in the Bhagavatam, it's mentioned that we have a dispensation that one has to actually carry out sinful activity before it's counted as a sin in Kali Yuga. Whereas in other ages, just the actual thought is a sin. So we have that little bit of leeway, thank God, in Kali Yuga, that we can think sinful things. But it shouldn't be taken as a sort of mandate to always think sinful. Because we should cleanse the mind, we don't have to ever think sinful things. But if somehow the mind slips into thinking sinful things, because we're coming for the deities every day and reading constantly and taking vows, we can be exonerated.